So the title of my talk, I just restart my clock. So the title of my talk is the Lightcomb bundle and its ultra-relativistic gauge symmetries. And basically it's based on my J publication from April at a macroscopic analog of the BMS group and also on yet unpublished results. And to summarize very concisely about what it will be about gauge groups for the light cone bundle. So gauge groups in the fiber bundle theoretic sense. And the light cone bundle is the bundle of all non-zero null vectors associated with a four-dimensional pseudo-Riemannian space-time. And the main result will be that new kind of symmetry groups appear as gauge groups for this bundle if one performs this analysis. And more concretely, the concrete facts are that the Lightcomb bundle is a Carolian fiber bundle in the sense that its fibers are Carolian manifolds, which is not that surprising since it's a bundle of light cones, the Carolian gauge groups in this situation are non-trivially represented Lorentz groups, that there is a certain ambiguity in those representations, and that the BMS-like group appears as a conformal Carolian gauge group, and basically that this group parameterizes this ambiguity from above. So those are the hard facts. Don't worry, I will present them more thoroughly during the talk. I just wanted so that you have an overview of what is happening. So my talk will have five sections. Two of those sections are quite qualitative, and three sections are a little bit more formal. So in the first section of the talk, I will explain to you what was my initial motivation that led to the study of the Lightcomb bundle, because basically it emerged from a quite different research project, and I want to explain to you why I thought at this time the Lightcomb bundle is interesting, so to motivate this study. And then in the second section, we will talk about Carolian geometric structures in the light cone bundle, because to analyze the symmetries of some geometric object, we have to analyze and understand its geometry. In the third section, we will talk about how to coordinateize the light cone bundle. So this sounds trivial, how to coordinate it, but basically we will see that there are some interesting subtleties when one tries to coordinate tangent light cones, and also one needs to understand the coordinate systems to understand the gauge groups in a fiber bundle theoretic sense, because gauge groups for fiber bundles are basically redundancies and trivializations. And in the fourth section, we then will finally be able to understand what are those Carolian gauge groups for this bundle. And in the fifth section, basically, I will present some science fiction, because basically, the study of the light cone bundle is just the first step in a research program at which I am aiming at. And I want to explain to you what I have in mind with those structures. So what interests me about this and why I think that it's useful to look at those structures. So I first talk about my motivation. So basically, the initial motivation came from a quite different area. Namely, I was interested in cosmological singularities, and I had a research project going on where I studied certain curvature singularities, so basically the most important curvature singularities, Kästner, Schwarzschild, and Friedmann, Robinson, Walker singularities. And in this study, I had basically two aims. So the first aim was I wanted to understand something which I call completeless results in the context of quantum field theory. So there are results by several people, for example, by Stefan Hofmann, Mark Schneider, and Abhay Ashtika and Mark Schneider, who have shown that cosmological singularities appear quite harmless if one probes them with quantum field theoretic observable algebras. So they call this a hint that the singularities are in some sense quantum complete, although the space-time appears incomplete if probed by point particles. And I was interested in the question, if this completeness behavior is merely caused by quantum non-commutativity of quantum fields, or if it is caused by some kind of extended character of the field. So I was, to say it in concrete terms, I was interested if this completeness behavior is induced by the classical field theory, which is used for quantization, or if this completeness behavior is really a quantum feature. So this was the first aim. And the second aim, I wanted to understand the geometric foundations of dimensional reduction and asymptotic silence in the vicinity of cosmological singularities. So in the first thing, this went quite well. There's a publication in preparation at the moment. And the second question is the question where the study of the light cone bundle emerged as an interesting thing to do. So I want to explain to you now what is dimensional reduction, asymptotic silence, so in very concise terms, because this is just the motivation for the rest of this talk. So dimensional reduction describes basically evidence from various approaches to quantum gravity, which somehow suggests that space-time behaves effectively lower dimensional on microscopic scales. the idea behind this is always the same. One uses some observable, to call it so, which is capable to estimate a dimension and calculates this observable in a quantum gravity theory at hand. For example, one calculates the spectral dimension, which is basically the heat kernel asymptotics. You know, the asymptotics of the heat kernel depends on the dimension. One can calculate this in causal dynamical triangulations. There, one can see that the dimension of space-time gets lower dimensional on microscopic scales. We can also do the same in asymptotic safety. And there are also other examples. I just want to sketch it, where one sees somehow that there's evidence that space-time is lower dimensional on microscopic scales in those theories. Also, we have a phenomenon called asymptotic silence, which is very picturally spoken, the idea that light cones collapse to lines on microscopic scales and nearby points, spatially separated nearby points, become causally disconnected. And the hints here is, for example, if one looks at the short distance Wheeler-DeWitt equation, which was quite an active area of research in the 80s, one sees that this equation becomes ultra-local in the limit where the Planck length goes to infinity. And ultra-local field theories are basically connected to the idea that the light cone collapses to a line and also are connected, hence, to the idea of a Carolian limit. And also, for example, Kalib looked at the Reicho-Dori equation in 2D Dilaton gravity, and he also saw this focusing of light cones on microscopic scales there. I don't want to go into details here now, so if you're interested in these topics, I recommend this very, very good essay by Stephen Kalib. I think there were weeks in my life where I read it 3 times a week because it's very, very, very nice. So I recommend this. Now the thing is that also there is some evidence that dimensional reduction in asymptotic silence happens in the vicinity of cosmological singularities. I also don't want to go into details here, but if one calculates, for example, the heat kernel in Kästner spacetimes or other kinds of propagators, one sees some peculiar behavior which hints at the direction that the spacetime dimension somehow becomes two-dimensional, or if one looks at geodesics in Kästner spacetimes. And for asymptotic silence, one of the biggest evidence for this in the vicinity of singularities is basically the famous BKL conjecture, which tells us that Einstein field equations become ultra-local in the vicinity of the cosmological singularity, which is also somehow a feature of asymptotic silence, of the collapsing of light cones. I read quite a lot about this. And I was always a little bit unsatisfied because I didn't really understand what are the geometric foundations of this, of dimensional reduction, asymptotic silence in the vicinity of singularities. So I somehow thought that the singularity, although the curvature diverges, it is a geometrically somehow well-defined object because we have a metric tensor, we have a manifold. So one should be able to understand better what it means that the dimension reduces and that the asymptotic silence happens. And also in those papers, although I found them very interesting, I didn't always understand, especially in these argumentations here, why those statements are really coordinate invariant. So my questions that bothered me were how to characterize dimensional reduction asymptotic silence invariantly in the vicinity of cosmological singularities, so coordinate invariantly, from the perspective of differential geometry, and how are dimensional reduction asymptotic silence are related to each other in this picture, because often they come somehow together. And so I hoped maybe in the case of a singularity, one can understand how they are connected. And for me, the motivation behind this is, or was, on the one hand, since I find dimensional reduction quite a cool concept, so I wanted to understand it, but also I see singularity somehow as a probe for gravity's strong field regime. And also, as I said, asymptotic silence and dimensional reduction also occur in other scenarios. So I thought, okay, maybe if we understand it precisely in the case of cosmological singularities, we can transfer this knowledge also to other cases. So to answer those questions, I really did quite a lot of stuff with singularities, and I calculated a lot and tried a lot of things. But one of the first things I did was I calculated just the geodesics in several singular spacetimes and several coordinate systems just to get an intuition what really happens there. And for example, for this talk, I now show you the geodesics in a simple Friedmann-Robinson-Walker spacetime. So I take conformal coordinates where the scale factor goes to zero, and especially I take now this scale factor, which includes cases like the matter-dominated universe or radiation-dominated universe, and I got basically this picture. So the singularity, I mean, this is the x eta plane, so this is conformal time, and this is just one space coordinate. And the x-axis basically is the singularity. And the orange lines are the time-like geodesics, the green lines are the space-like geodesics, and the dashed line is the light cone. Because we are in conformal coordinates, the light cone just appears as a Minkowski space. And what one sees here is that time-like and space-like geodesics somehow seem to approach the light cone when we go towards the singularity. So of course, I thought at first, okay, maybe this is just a coordinate artifact, because, you know, in general relativity, one always has to be careful about the coordinate systems. But two things for this. The first thing is, this really is a qualitative behavior of some geodesics with respect to other geodesics. So not with respect to a coordinate frame, but of geodesics with respect to another geodesics. And on the second thing is, one really can put this into some kind of invariant statement, at least in Friedman-Robinson-Walker space-times and Kästner space-times, because there we have the three space-like killing vector fields by which we can define momenta. And with this, one can write down this equation. I explain it. The idea is that we have a geodesic that we can associate to each geodesic vector field a momentum p, a space-like momentum p, and we can compare time-like minus one and space-like plus one geodesic vector fields associated with a momentum p with the corresponding null geodesic vector fields of the same momentum. And this tensor basically here makes this comparison, and this tensor is defined entirely in terms of invariant objects, because geodesic vector fields are invariantly defined, momenta are invariantly defined, and if something is time, space-like, or null is invariantly defined, and one sees that this tensor goes to the identity tensor towards the singularity, and identity tensor is identity tensor in any coordinate system. So there's a certain chance that this is really a coordinate invariant feature, and as a side note, I just want to say there are some subtleties, because one has to distinguish if the diffeomorphisms which change between our coordinate systems degenerate towards the singularity or not. So if the determinant of the Jacobian is finite towards the singularity, everything is fine, then this equation holds in any coordinate system. If the diffeomorphism degenerates towards the singularity, so if the Jacobian goes to zero or goes to infinity, sorry, the determinant of the Jacobian, then basically, if this equation is preserved, depends on the asymptotics, but it's still preserved for a very large class of asymptotic behavior. But there is still some work to do. Someone has to classify these diffeomorphisms, understand their physical properties, and so on and so on. And I'm on it, but it will still take some while. But the interesting thing is now, this really suggests some kind of Carolian physics at the singularities. So I found it quite interesting because, you know, in the case of black holes, horizons are Carolian objects, and now if the singularity also has some kind of Carolian behavior, this fascinated me. But one really sees, if one looks at this picture and takes it seriously, that it's some kind of different kind of Carolian limit, because not the light cone collapses to a line, but the geometry of the tangent spaces, or to say the geometry of normal neighborhoods, gets deformed towards the light cone. And yes?
If you allow for such a diffeomorphism that are similar at a point, isn't it possible to continue the radial geodesics in Schwarzschild beyond the singularity?
Mm. I was thinking about that. So I have more the impression that what one can do is, so for me, it seems for me, to endow the singular hypersurface with a kind of ultra-relativistic structure. But a little bit the problem is, maybe we should discuss this later, because I have a little bit of a tight schedule. The problem is, this equation basically, if you look at the geodesic with momentum zero, the geodesic with momentum zero is something like, how to say in English, a borderline case, because this cannot be deformed towards the light cone. But what it does is, this equation here holds nevertheless, because for all other geodesics, the affine, the tangent vector, the length of the tangent vector goes to infinity, but for this one, it stays finite. So if one takes the null geodesic as a kind of reference frame, this geodesic, the length of its tangent vector vanishes. Do you understand what I want to say? And there I have the feeling, I don't really know if one can really glue a space inside here so that the geometry goes further. But what I think is that one can look at some kind of ultra-relativistic boundary constructions. But we can talk about this later again. So, and basically, the question was quite a good to the next thing, namely what we see is if we look at so local or microscopic geometry of this manifold, the normal neighborhoods get deformed towards the light cone somehow. And if we are on the singularity, basically we don't need a tangent, full tangent space anymore. We just somehow only need a tangent light cone. Therefore, I was thinking, okay, maybe the ultra-relativistic boundary, ultra-relativistic singular boundary here, maybe is some kind of light cone bundle over the singularity. And this was my motivation, my first motivation. Then I thought, okay, I should really understand the Carolian features if I just have tangent light cones and not full tangent spaces. And basically, there is also another motivation, which I will call here a qualitative conclusion by analogy. So this is quite a wild argumentation, but I was drinking a cup of tea and I was a little bit thinking about this, and then I reached at this conclusion somehow. Namely, as I said, my intuition sometimes is that singularities can be understood as some probe for gravity's strong field regime. And as I said, we made the observation that for short time scales around certain singularities, geometry seems to be dominated by ultra-relativistic behavior. And I said before, we have also asymptotic silence and dimensional reduction. So I thought, okay, maybe this is also related to this kind of asymptotic ultra-relativistic behavior. And as I said before, asymptotic silence and dimensional reduction are not only tied to singularities, but they are present in many other approaches to quantum gravity. So I was wondering, okay, maybe also in those cases, this behavior is present. And this basically made the conclusion in my mind, okay, could it be that on fundamental scales, so if we have this asymptotic light-like behavior on fundamental scales, anything moves at the speed of light, somewhat at our usual geometry is emergent. So at the first glimpse, I thought, okay, this idea is very stupid because obviously things don't move at the speed of light. But one can make a little Gedanken experiment, and basically this is not from me. This is it occurs several times in literature, for example, in Feynman's checkerboard model or Penrose zigzag model. But here we apply it on the case of space-time geometry, and the idea is if we have on macroscopic scales, a time-like motion, one cannot really decide if this motion is really time-like or if it's somehow null with a discretization that is very, 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 very fine. So this basically motivated for me the idea, okay, maybe it could really be the case that microscopically anything moves at the speed of light and our space-time geometry just supports this motion, but on macroscopic scales, maybe relativity is emergent. And I was wondering what are the features of such a theory, and of course it's hard to answer this question without doing too much bullshit, but I was thinking that we always know that symmetry is quite a good guiding principle. So I think, okay, if we have a situation where microscopically anything moves at the speed of light in our space-time, what are the impossible gauge symmetries of such a theory of gravity? And I mean here gauge symmetries in the fiber bundle sense. So if we formulate this theory with gauge connections and so on. And if this motivation is a little bit too wild for you, it's okay for me, but I have also a less wild motivation, namely, one can consider the case where we have a pseudo-Riemannian space-time, but we only allow for massless classical test particles as probes. And this is a situation where obviously anything moves at the speed of light. And we know that usually Carolian symmetries are tied to situations where anything moves at the speed of light. So one can ask, okay, what are the Carolian symmetries in this situation? Because obviously it's a pseudo-Riemannian space-time which has Lorentzian symmetries. So where is Carol here? And those are the three motivations which motivated me to study the symmetries of the light cone bundle. So you can choose what's your favorite motivation. And now we go on and talk about the Carolian structures on the light cone bundle. So now we can forget anything I told you in the first section. This was just to motivate why I found it interesting to study this. So the light cone bundle is just a simple geometric entity. So we take a 3+1 dimensional time and space orientable Lorentzian space-time with this signature. So you see I'm not a mostly minus guy. And if anything moves at the speed of light, this means basically that all tangent vectors lie in tangent light cones. So the idea is we don't need a tangent bundle. We just need a sub-bundle which constitutes out of tangent light cones, and it's readily defined like this. It's just a disjoint union at each. Yeah.
Lydia has a question in the chat. Maybe you wanna.
Hello.
Yes.
Hi. Yes. Is there a relation? Go ahead. Sorry. Is there a relation to relative locality?
Is there a relation
to
locality?
And what?
Relation to
relative locality.
Mm. I don't completely understand what you mean exactly with locality, but I would make one suggestion.
Relative locality, but that if you don't know that, discuss it later.
Okay. Sorry, but we can talk about this after the talk. Really, it's no problem for me. I just have a little bit of a tight schedule to get finished at after 50 minutes. But after that, we can discuss as long as you want, because I like discussions. But now I'll hurry up a little bit. So the bundle of future pointing light cones is readily defined. It's just a disjoint union over all tangent light cones, cones at point P. And a tangent light cone is just a set of all null vectors at this point without the zero vector, and since we choose our space-time to be time-orientable, I will just look at the future-pointing light cones here. And it is basically a sub-fiber bundle of the tangent bundle. And here is a picture of it. I mean, everybody of you think could have imagined it without a picture, but the picture is quite nice. So that's what it is. And now we want to look at the geometric structures on this light cone bundle. So we ask which geometric structures are induced on the light cone bundle by the geometry of the pseudo-Riemannian manifold, or to say so, by the geometry of the tangent bundle. So the first thing is quite trivial, the topology and the smooth structure. Basically, each tangent light cone is diffeomorphic to the two-sphere times the positive real number. So due to the half-line bundle over the two-sphere, it's quite obvious because the light cone is a cone and this is just a cone. And in addition, we have that the vector space structure of the tangent spaces induces a cone structure on the tangent light cone, which is also quite obvious because the light cone is a light cone. What I mean with that is that there's no addition, of two null vectors induced on the tangent light cones, because the sum of two null vectors mustn't be a null vector. But you can multiply a null vector with a positive real number, and this induces something which is called in math a cone. So we have a cone structure here. Now we come to a less trivial ingredient, namely what the metric induces on a tangent light cone. Basically, the metric induces a distance function on each tangent light cone. The idea behind this is we can insert two null vectors into the metric evaluated at a tangent space at point P, and then we see that the metric basically has the axioms of a distance function, with one important difference, namely, as we know, if we measure the distance of two null vectors pointing in the same direction, it is zero. And this distance function then can be infinitesimalized and leads to a Riemannian metric on the tangent light cone. And this Riemannian metric basically is degenerate because of the property that two null vectors pointing in the same direction have zero distance, to say so. And this metric has also a kernel, and this kernel is generated by the cone structure, in the sense that this multiplication law basically induces a diffeomorphism on a tangent light cone, and this induces a vector field, and this vector field generates the kernel of this metric. And basically this says that each tangent light cone is basically a Carroll manifold, because each tangent light cone is endowed with a nowhere vanishing vector field induced by the cone structure, and a symmetric covariant degenerate 2 tensor with one-dimensional kernel generated by this, and this is basically the definition of a Carroll manifold. So the idea is that the light cone bundle, so the bundle of all light cones, is basically some kind of Carolian fiber bundle. This means a fiber bundle where any fiber is a Carroll manifold and endowed with a Carolian structure. And picturally spoken, one can say that it captures some sense the microscopic ultra-relativistic geometry of a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time. So very concisely, to recall it again, if you have at point P a tangent light cone, then this tangent light cone is embedded in the tangent space. In the tangent space, we have the metric. The metric, basically, you can use it to measure the distance between two null vectors. The distance will be zero if they point in the same direction. This distance function then gives a kind of degenerate Riemannian metric on the tangent light cone. So in each tangent space, at the tangent light cone, we have an inner product. And in addition, we have that the cone structure gives a vector field by this multiplication law. And this vector field generates the kernel of this. So this is just in a picture. OK, and in the sequel, I will call this QP the light cone metric at P. And now we've seen that the light cone bundle is a kind of Carolian entity, and it's a kind of natural Carolian entity, geometric entity associated with any pseudo-Riemannian space-time. And we see other Carolian entities are, for example, null infinity, which we know already quite well, so scry minus and scry plus. And we have also embedded null surfaces, which are also Carroll manifolds. And now we have basically a third Carolian entity, which is the bundle of all light cones. And this motivates basically a fourth motivation for the study of the light cone bundle, because we know that study of gravity on null surfaces or on Carolian surfaces leads often to great simplifications and nice insights, for example, at null infinity with the usual BMS stuff, or on embedded null surfaces. So, for example, at the paper of Ciambelli and the work of Laurent Freidel in the last years, or also at horizons. And basically, this motivates, okay, maybe also gravity simplifies if we analyze it on a light cone bundle. And the idea is, maybe we can analyze ultra-relativistic aspects of gravity via tools from gauge theory on Faber bundles. And the motivation, too, is that null surfaces basically correspond to integrable sub-bundles of the light cone bundle. So the idea is we can use Frobenius' theorem to associate sub-bundles to null surfaces, and maybe one can derive features of null surfaces from the corresponding gauge theory on the light cone bundle. So this is another motivation, but before we can study connections on a light cone bundle, we first have to analyze the gauge groups, because without gauge groups, yeah?
Sorry, by integrable in the previous slide. By integrable, you mean the Niehaus tensor is zero.
I think so. Basically, what I mean is that it satisfies the prerequisites of Frobenius' theorem.
Some vector fields, they might form locally two-dimensional space, but we cannot integrate them to a surface.
Yeah, that's right.
We can integrate them to a surface.
And the condition is that the Niehaus tensor has to...
It might be the same. Basically, I have more Frobenius' theorem in mind, but...
That's
something you prove, or that's a condition?
And then basically, that one has to prove. So the idea is, basically, you analyze gauge connections on a light cone bundle, and then you have the idea, okay, null surfaces are corresponding to sub-bundles. So if you restrict this theory maybe on sub-bundles, you get knowledge on null surfaces. So this is basically just an idea one has to perform. I'm not talking about this in this talk, because this is science fiction. But what I want to say is this is a motivation why I think it's useful to study this bundle. And before we are able to study connections on this bundle, so to make this stuff, we first have to analyze possible Carolian gauge groups. And this is basically the subject of the talk. But unfortunately, before we are coming to the Carolian gauge groups, we now first have to talk about coordinate systems for a light cone bundle. And this is quite interesting, although it doesn't look like it would be interesting. So I first want to recap very concisely what gauge groups are in the fiber bundle context. And I don't want to recap this using definitions, because this would have used many slides for this. So I thought I'd be talking about an example just to calibrate our language. Let's consider the tangent bundle of some manifold. We now forget that it's a space-time just for a manifold. The idea is now that the geometry of the manifold, basically, because it's a manifold, gives the property that there exists this natural tangent bundle, and that this tangent bundle has a vector space structure. And since it has a vector space structure, it gives a distinguished class of trivializations, so of frames, coordinate patches for this bundle. And those coordinate patches are induced by vector space frames. And by this, the gauge group for the tangent bundle basically is a general linear group. If we now have, in addition, a pseudo-Riemannian metric, this again induces a distinguished class of coordinate systems, namely orthonormal frames. And then the gauge group is reduced to those transformations which preserve orthonormality, and then the gauge group is the usual orthonormal group or Lorentz group. And if the space-time is in addition space and time-orientable, then the gauge group is further reduced to the proper autochronous Lorentz group, and so on and so on. And the general strategy is always look at coordinate systems for the bundle, express geometric structures in those coordinate systems, and look at transformations that preserve those properties. So this is just as one does it always in fiber bundle theory, and hence we have to look now at coordinate systems for a light cone bundle. So the question is, how to coordinateize a single tangent light cone at point P? And the idea is basically quite simple. As I said, it's diffeomorphic to the two-sphere times the positive real number, so the line bundle over the two-sphere. And the idea behind this is basically if you have a light ray, if I would have a laser pointer in my hand, then I could characterize it via its direction on a two-sphere and its color, and the color is mainly the length of a momentum vector. So this is the idea behind its identification. And as people who do stuff with light cones know, the two sphere is quite inconvenient. We better use the Riemann sphere, which is just the one-point compactification of the complex line, the complex plane. And the idea is then that we coinitize the tangent light cone via the line bundle over the Riemann sphere. So the direction on the Riemann sphere, to say the celestial sphere at point P times the length. So this is everything not so complicated. It means, as I said, we identify light cones with the half-line bundle of the Riemann sphere. Interesting thing now is that this identification here has a richer structure than the usual stereographic projection here. This comes because the notion of a length for null vectors is ambiguous, as we've seen soon. So we first recap how to associate a null vector direction, a direction to a null vector. This is quite standard. I think anybody of you knows this. So the idea is we have a free Fehlbein frame around this point P, and this Fehlbein frame induces an associated stereographic projection just by this standard formula. Sometimes people make here a plus. I used to take here a minus, but it doesn't matter. And by this we see that we have for any Fehlbein frame basically an associated stereographic projection. And Lorentz transformation acts then in this coordinatization, to say it so, via Möbius transformation, as you know. So if we look at a stereographic projection of a Lorentz transformed null vector, this basically is a Möbius transformation of the stereographic projection of the original null vector. And the Möbius transformation is such a rational map on the Riemann sphere. And they form a group, the Möbius group. And basically by this observation, one sees that the Möbius group is isomorphic to the group of Lorentz transformations. And the Möbius group is basically the conformal group of the two sphere in the sense of complex geometry. So it preserves the complex conformal structure, to say it so. So this is how it works with null vector directions. Now we come to the next topic, namely the length of a null vector. So often the length of a null vector is not considered as a meaningful concept, since the metric is degenerate on the light cone. So people say there is no canonical length notion for null vectors. For example, Penrose writes in his beautiful book, Spinors and Spacetime, the extent, so he called what I call a length, he calls an extent. The extent of a null vector cannot be characterized in an invariant way by a number, nor can null vectors of different directions be compared with respect to extent. The ratio of the extents of null vectors with the same direction is meaningful, being just the ratio of the null vectors. But basically, I would like to say things don't have to be invariant for being meaningful. For example, you may think that this is a stupid example, but we will see it's not a stupid example. If you look at the Minkowski 4 vector is not invariant on the Lorentz transformations, it's Lorentz covariant. And still meaningful, namely because it has a well-defined transformation property under Lorentz transformations. So the idea is we don't look at Lorentz invariant length notions, but we look at Lorentz covariant length notions. And then quite a rich theory emerges. Namely, I will now call any smooth map which associates to a null vector a kind of length, a length gauge. And that it's a length is formalized by the idea that it's homogeneous under this rescalings. And then one can show that any such map, I mean, this looks like magic, but it's really not hard to show that any such map behaves under Lorentz transformations as follows. Namely, if you measure the length of a Lorentz transformed null vector, this is some rescaling times the original length, and the rescaling just depends on the direction of the null vector, so the initial direction of the null vector, and the Lorentz transformation we applied. And moreover, this rescaling function satisfies some kind of covariance law. So if we look at the rescaling of two, if we perform two Lorentz transformations iteratively and look at the rescaling, it basically factorizes in this way. And this is also called a two co-cycle property. And by this, we say that there are Lorentz covariant length notions. And to convince you, I will give you now a simple example. So we just look at a simple length gauge, which is just a zeroth component of the null vector measured in some Fehlbein frame. In this case, the rescaling function is given by this. I mean, people who do celestial holographies saw this maybe all the time. And this function here satisfies this covariance law, as one can easily show by just formal manipulation. And this basically gives us now the idea how to coordinatize the light cone bundle, namely answer by local trivializations, which restrict on each tangent light cone to such a map where a null vector gets mapped on its direction on the Riemann sphere and its length with respect to some length gauge. And as we already see, is that we have here a much larger gauge group if you look at this, namely because we have much more length gauges than Lorentz transformations and that we are going to formalize soon. So now the next step to analyze the gauge symmetries, basically we have to understand how the Carolian structures look like in those coordinate systems. As I said, we look then at the coordinate expressions of the Carolian structures and then we can look at the symmetry groups for them. And this is not so complicated. So how does the light cone metric look like in those trivializations? And the answer is,
understanding, just to make sure I understand. You're basically, let's say, you pick a canonical time direction 1, 0, 0, 0. Then you can you split the Lorentz group into boosts and rotations. And now you look at the boost projected along your given null vector. This does exactly the Dirichlet scaling you want. That's what you're talking about.
Basically, yes, because
but it's the action of this element of the Lorentz group.
Basically, yes. I mean, the length gauge is the way how to measure the length, and one possibility is to choose a time-like vector and use it basically as a ruler to measure the length of a null vector.
Sure.
But it's one possibility, so it's most simplest one. One can then look at the Lorentz transformation properties of this length gauge, and this is basically a change.
This transformation that you're calling gauge is the result of actually acting with one of the Lorentz group generators. The one that is actually the boost projected along the direction of the null vector.
Yes, basically you can.
That's what you're calling gauge transformation. Right?
Basically, yes, the length gauge transformation. It does like this because basically this is a cross section.
But just to make sure that that's what you're talking about.
Okay, yes, I'm talking about this. So. And we have to look at the coordinate expressions for those Carolian structures. So the question is, how does the light cone metric now look in those trivializations? And the answer is, if we perform the push forward of the light cone metric, it looks like this. So you have a conformal factor, and this conformal factor basically depends on the length gauge you have chosen. And for example, if you take the zero, this again as a length gauge, then you have this as a conformal factor, which is the standard conformal factor for a curvature one cross section. So how to interpret this is now from an extrinsic perspective, we have the stereographic projection induces a conformal structure on the Riemann sphere via pullback of the metric. This means if we have the metric on our tangent space under the stereographic projection, this induces a full class of conformally equivalent metrics on the celestial sphere. From an intrinsic perspective, this conformal structure is induced by the complex geometry of the Riemann sphere. Now the idea is that the length gauge basically breaks this conformal invariance by choosing such a preferred metric out of this class. And this will be a little bit more important later. So summary, what we have gained so far. We have understood that each tangent light cone is isomorphic to this line bundle over the sphere via local trivializations. And this identification, the metric on the tangent space basically looks like this, where the conformal factor depends on the chosen length gauge. And in addition, we have still this cone structure here, which is such this multiplication law. And those properties, two properties now, give a Carolian structure now on this space, which we use to coordinateize the fiber bundles. And now, basically, we can analyze the symmetry groups that preserve those structures. So now we are coming to the Carolian gauge symmetry groups. So assume, again, we have identified a single tangent light cone with this bundle. Then the Carolian structure, as I said, you have a light cone metric which has this coordinate expression, and you have this cone structure. We look at the transformations which preserve this. You have two possibilities, two extremal possibilities, either isometries or conformal transformations. So isometries, basically, these are Carolian isometries which map the conformal factor on the conformal factor. And you have conformal transformations which basically change the conformal factor. So we first look at the conformal Carolian gauge group. Those are automorphisms of this ball letter C plus. I've defined it some slides before, but I forgot to say it. This is just the line bundle over the sphere. So this is the Riemann sphere times the positive real numbers. So those are homogeneous maps which preserve the cone structure under which the light cone metric gets mapped to conformally equivalent light cone metric. And it is a right semi-direct product. I call it mu BMS. So I will explain to you soon why. And this right semi-direct product structure is not so important because I will explain to you what it does. It's also quite obvious. The idea is it acts on the light cone via a change of a cross section. So basically, it is some kind of super rescaling in the light cone. And the composition law says now, if we compose two of such group elements, which are made out of a Lorentz transformation and such an arbitrary rescaling, then the second Lorentz transformation rigidly transforms the first rescaling with it. So it's not a very complicated group structure. And it maps the conformal factor under pullback on such a conformally related one. So the next two slides are quite formal, but after then it will be a little bit more lighthearted again. So this is the conformal Carolian gauge group, to call it so. And now, interesting thing is that you have plenty of isometric Carolian gauge groups which preserve the light cone metric. Namely, as I said, basically one can see this in this slide. If you want to have an isometry, this rescaling must compensate for this change and for this change to get again the original conformal factor. And by this, basically, an isometric group which preserves the metric is a subgroup of this conformal group, in the sense that the rescalings, to say it so, are rigidly fixed by the Lorentz transformations. And you have again such a rescaling function, and this rescaling function again satisfies this covariance law. So basically, you have infinitely many Lorentz subgroups. Here you see that for any length gauge and any induced conformal factor, you have an associated Lorentz subgroup of the conformal Carroll gauge group, which basically preserves this conformal factor. And we see hence that the representation of this Lorentz group as a Carroll group in this coordinate system depends hence on the length gauge used for the identification. I will comment on this soon again. And in addition, any such representation defines, as I said, a Lorentz subgroup of this conformal group. And basically, one can generalize this to a larger theory, namely, any such map which satisfies this property, and those maps then must not come from conformal factors. One really can use other maps which also satisfy this property, define an associated Lorentz subgroup. So this conformal group has really infinitely many Lorentz subgroups. And now the formal part is over. Now we'll come to the interpretation of this finding. What does this mean, basically? It basically means that this conformal Carolian gauge group parameterizes the ambiguity in length gauges for these tangent light cones. Namely, each Lorentz subgroup of this conformal gauge group corresponds to a length gauge and its associated Lorentz covariance law. And that we have infinitely many Lorentz subgroups means now that there are infinitely many Lorentz covariant length gauges with associated Lorentz transformation laws. And this, of course, raises the question, what is the natural gauge group for a light cone bundle? Is it some Lorentz group? Is it the microscopic BMS group, the mu BMS group, as I called it there? And basically, what I want to say here is that any Lorentz subgroup of mu BMS induces now a preferred length gauge by breaking this conformal symmetry with an associated Lorentz transformation law. This means if we choose a subgroup, we basically can measure the length of a null vector. So the question is the length of a null vector an intrinsic property of a null vector or not? If it is an intrinsic property, then we have to choose a Lorentz subgroup.
Or the opposite. There is nothing canonical about this Poincaré subgroup you've picked, precisely because it corresponds to a choice of extent which is arbitrary and non-physical. That would be the usual lesson, right?
Basically, I don't think so. We'll see in the next slide why I think that there is a meaning inside there. And I think from an intrinsic perspective, I have the feeling that this group is more natural than any of its Lorentz subgroups. And of course, to answer this, one have to analyze this in a more dynamical context, I think. But now I want to explain to you why I think that there is some meaning inside this. Namely, as I said now, any length gauge induces identification of the tangent light cone at point P with this line bundle over the Riemann sphere and has hence an associated conformal factor there. And we had already this length gauge here, and this length gauge here is a special type which gives this conformal factor. And this length gauge, which we had already, basically can be written just as the just a zero of Fielbein together the Minkowski inner product with the zero Fielbein and the null vector inside it. And we can generalize it to any time-like vector. And the interesting thing is now that if you have any time-like vector, the induced conformal factor can be written like this for the time-like vector t0, t1, t2, t3, with the usual coordinates in the Fielbein frame, where this y's here are spherical harmonics, And this basically gives a linear Lorentz equivariant isomorphism between the convex cone of time-like vectors and a space of conformal factors. And this is quite interesting, in my opinion. What it says is that at any such conformal factor induces an associated Lorentz subgroup of this conformal automorphism group. And basically, what this says, summarizes, that the convex cone of time-like vectors can be understood intrinsically on this bundle as a space of conformal factors, and that any such conformal factor singles then out a subgroup of this microscopic BMS group as its Carolian isometry group. And this can be interpreted in two ways. So extrinsic perspective, subgroups of BMS don't have an intrinsic meaning. They are extrinsically induced by non-null geometry, basically. So they encode the information which is non-null. And the other idea is, the more intrinsic perspective is, that the time-like geometry of the tangent space can be understood under some kind of conformal symmetry breaking as a space of conformal factors. So I really want to say, this is really a vector space. It is a linear Lorentz equivalent isomorphism. So the convex cone of time-like vectors emerges as a vector space of spherical harmonics on the sphere. And there's also some connection of this to conformally and spin-weighted spherical harmonics, but we are looking at this with a different perspective. And this is why I think that there is a meaning in this subgroup, which is usually omitted if one just looks at the celestial sphere, basically. But we can talk about this. I have no problem with this. So, and now basically I want to explain to you why I called it MuBMS. Basically, it's a little bit a clickbait name, but basically those both groups are quite similar in structure. As we know, spacetimes, which are asymptotically Minkowski, are at null infinity endowed with some kind of universal structure. It is topology like this, and also our tangent light cone has a similar topology. I mean, it's not surprising, because null infinity is basically the light cone in Einstein's static universe, and we're also looking at some kind of light cone. So they have similar properties. We have a degenerate matrix, so on a tangent light cone, it has the same signature. We have a complete null vector field in null infinity, and on our tangent light cone, we have this convex cone structure, which is quite similar, and the Bronnie-Messner-Sachs group is a group of mappings, which is our conformal transformations on this universal structure, and also our group does that for our structure, and it also is a right semi-direct product as our group. And now, of course, the Bronnie-Messner-Sachs group is much more non-trivial because it's involved in description of gravitational radiation. But basically, this is the question which interests me. So how does gravitational radiation look in a light cone bundle? Does it simplify? And so on and so on. And here we see it again, why we have an analogy. Basically, the microscopic tangent light cones are some kind of microscopic analog of the structure at null infinity, in a sense that there are light cones. So now I come to some science fiction. This is basically why I think that this could be interesting. And the first thing is, as I said, and as you know, the analysis of gravity often simplifies on null surfaces and Carolian entities. So the question is, does it somehow simplify on the light cone bundle? And as I said, the question is motivated by the simplification on other null geometric structures. And therefore, one should study gauge connections on the light cone bundle. Basically, there must be a P here. This is a typo. I'm sorry. One should study gauge connections on the light cone bundle, should look how Einstein's equation can be reformulated for those gauge connections, and so on. And another idea is, which is basically motivated by this idea of the emergence of special relativity on the line bundle over the Riemann sphere, is maybe it is possible to write down a gravitational theory for this group so that general relativity is connected to this under some kind of disconformal symmetry breaking. And the interesting thing for me is that then we would have the pseudo-Riemannian geometry basically as a prediction out of null geometry. And I find this quite interesting. I don't know if this works. I'm working on it, so let's see. And the last thing is, which is a little bit more wild, but I think it's quite interesting. Usually, Carolian geometry is somehow derived from pseudo-Riemannian geometry by saying, by embedding null surfaces or by performing an ultra-relativistic limit. And the question is, can one reverse the logics in the sense that one can determine a geometry by ultra-relativistic features? And this is motivated by three things, namely, first by this conformal invariance breaking we saw, where we basically get a pseudo-Riemannian spacetime somehow emergent on the light cones, then it's also motivated by the fact that there are results in the literature which basically say that the microscopic structure of space-time, so the microscopic geometric features of space-time, like causality or topology, are fixed to a great extent by null geometric features. For example, Penrose and Kronheimer showed in 67 and Minguzzi in 2009 that for a large class of space-times, null relations generate causal relations. And also Borchers and Hegerfeld showed that if you have Minkowski space-time and you look at maps which preserves light cones, those maps are necessarily Lorentz-Poincaré transformations. And one could ask, okay, maybe one can use ultra-relativity on microscopic scales to determine the geometry of space-time. And the idea behind this is that maybe this could be a more general framework for addressing the geometry of space-time, so where we don't get a manifold structure on microscopic scales, but some other structure which gives a manifold structure on effective scales. And this idea is basically motivated by the question from the beginning, where I was wondering how to find a geometry which reduces its dimension on the microscopic scale, and where asymptotic silence holds in the microscopic scales. And maybe with those ideas, one can define such a space-time. I don't know, but this quite interests me. And the last idea is that, suggested by this picture, that one can look at null discretizations of space-times as a model. So the idea is, basically this was already suggested in the literature. For example, Minguzzi suggested to replace causal relations in causal set theory by null relations, and then one should analyze if such a theory is capable to reproduce relativity in the macroscopic limit and to understand what are its features, so maybe if there are some corrections or whatsoever. I think this is interesting because if this really should work out, it could give a quite interesting perspective on the nature of space-time, because it would say, okay, speed of light is not the maximum velocity, but there's only one velocity of information exchange. And somehow, with some mechanism, effectively on macroscopic scales, we get the relativity picture we know. So those are four directions I'm quite interested in. And no personal statement, I think that the light cone bundle and the SMU-BMS group and its structure are previously unnoticed Carolian geometric entities, and basically nobody knows their features, and I think it's worth to research it. And I also think that, like I said, that looking at the small-scale structure of space-time from the perspective of ultra-relativistic geometry could give a more general framework for addressing the small-scale structure of space-time. And this null discretizations at the end are, in my opinion, as I said, interesting perspective, and it's substantially under research, although there are some research works, basically two I know, which address that. And unfortunately, Mr. Schaden died not long after his publication, so he wasn't able to look at this further. So now I'm finished, basically almost in time. Okay. Thank you.
Is there any questions?
So Madeline's theorem that says that the causal structure and the conformal factor determine the metric, I'm wondering how that affects this story. Is the idea that there are some configurations of the light cone bundle that wouldn't correspond to a metric?
basically something like this is the idea. So what I have here in mind, I can explain it to you now what I have in mind, but I would prefer to explain it to you personally, because I have some idea which is basically a generalization of twister spaces. So the idea is in twister spaces you can identify an event in space-time with the embedding of a celestial sphere, of a Riemann sphere into twister space. So with the embedding of a light cone, basically, into the space of null lines. Now one could ask the question, if one has microscopically a structure where you don't embed celestial spheres, but two-dimensional light cones or something like this in some crazy way, so that effectively you maybe get the Riemannian geometry. So this is some direction I have here in mind, how I could imagine that it works out. But basically, I wanted to talk with twister experts about this, because you know, twister literature is vast, and maybe some people tried this already. Yeah.
Go ahead.
No, go deep.
Yes. The one thing that doesn't come up very much in your discussion, which is very beautiful and very interesting, is chiral structure.
Mm-hmm.
If it came up at all, I would be tempted to say the structure you're looking at is related to Plovansky, to the Plovansky geometry, geometry of Plovansky theory.
I didn't understand you acoustically. So maybe can you write your question in chat? Because somehow it's a little bit hard to understand for me.
Okay. Is there any relation between what you're looking for and Plovansky theory? The theory of the Plovansky version of the Einstein equation.
He's asking about chiral structure and if there's any relation to Plovansky's formulation of general relativity.
Basically, I've never thought about this, but I can imagine, basically, now I have to go back. I mean, you know, there's this that Penrose zigzag model and Feynman's checkerboard model basically aimed at, so where is it? Wait a moment, I have it here. So basically, Penrose zigzag model basically is, the idea behind this was to have an intuition for the Higgs effect acting on wild spirals. So the idea is you have a massless wild spiral and you look at it in the Feynman diagram and this gives a null line and Higgs, now the Higgs effect changes the direction of this null line, and by this you have a massive massive chiral object emerging. Also a similar idea was with Feynman's checkerboard. So basically, if one place those ideas of Feynman's checkerboard in Penrose zigzag model, maybe one has some kind of connection with chirality. I don't know, but I mean chirality is the idea behind Feynman's checkerboard, basically. So therefore, it could be. But I never thought about this, so thanks. That's a very nice input.
One quick thing. David Finkelstein explored the structure you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So look into David Finkelstein's papers.
Yeah, I'll have a look. I mean, there's so many papers. I'm always happy if someone finds some connection out. So thank you. I'll have a look on this.
But Finkelstein was a specialist in this. He asked exactly the question you're asking.
Okay, so thank you.
Luca?
Yeah, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I have a question. I was wondering how your conformal chiral group and your mu BMS groups, how they compare to the previous literature. There is a paper in 2014 by Duval, Gibbons, and Hobarty that started all this business of conformal chiral versus BMS. There it is explicitly shown that the conformal chiral group on level 2 is isomorphic to BMS when we restrict to the 2-sphere. And they have a section on light cone, and they talk about the conformal chiral group of the light cone and BMS realization on that. So I was wondering, does your result generalize what they did, or have you compared?
Sorry, I didn't want to interrupt you. Sorry.
No, go ahead. I was just wondering that.
Basically, it's a side aspect of this. So what given Sovati and Duval did in their paper, they were looking for the symmetries of the light cone embedded into Minkowski space-time. And I'm looking at the light cone embedded into Minkowski vector space. So this is the difference because we have different structures here. Here, and we look at the Minkowski light cone embedded in space-time. But my object compared to the construction of the BMS group in the paper of Duval is basically I'm looking at tangent space at the origin and looking basically on the BMS group of this infinitesimal tangent light cone. So this is the connection. The difference is basically that on Minkowski space you don't have this natural action of the multiplication because it's a space-time, while in the tangent space, because it's a vector space, it's a linear space, this is a structure which has to be preserved. So this is basically one idea we can see this. And the third aspect, which I would like to emphasize it, is that, like I said, Gibbons, Duval, and Horvati did it on the Minkowski light cone embedded into Minkowski space, and this group here basically could be understood as a BMS group acting on momentum space, because momentum space is a vector space. And was this sufficient as an answer?
Yeah, no, thank you. I look forward to discuss this further with you. And another question that I had, but I don't know whether there are other questions, so I have time, is that in a paper we wrote in 2019 with Rob Lee and Marius Petropoulos, we showed the presence of Carolian a representation of BMS on each Carolian structure. Mm-hmm. So I was wondering, once you identify the tangent bundle that you're dealing with as a Carolian structure, are you able to compare your new BMS with our BMS in 2019, or is that different?
Basically, I didn't understand your question completely, because somehow it's a little bit hard to understand from here with the loudspeakers. So basically, I asked the question if I compared the new BMS with the original BMS in terms of the structure.
No, so the question is that whenever you have a Carolian structure, you can define a set of local conformal isometries of the structure that you can show are a representation of the BMS group.
Ah, okay.
So I was wondering how your mu BMS is related to that.
Okay. Basically, this I don't know. Maybe I have one idea how to address this question. Namely, basically, on the light column in a vector space, we have some kind of canonical connection which is induced by the cone structure. So this connection basically makes this Carolian vector field fixes it. So you cannot make different types of rescaling at different points of the tangent light cone. So is this the direction we are addressing at?
Sorry, can you repeat? I'm not sure I understood your question.
Okay.
The audio is a bit low, sorry.
Did this, now what I say, go into the direction you were asking for?
Yes?
Luca, if it's too hard, maybe we could cut it, because it starts to become a technical question and you can continue discussing with
Sorry to bother. Yeah, we'll continue later. Thank you very much, Daniel. Thank you, sorry. Sorry about this.
Can Zoom on it anytime?
Yeah, I think it's maybe it's Zoom, because it's hard to understand what you're saying, Luca, yes. Here, and it seems that it's hard for you to understand. So that's why it's kind of starting to... So maybe you should continue on Zoom just after. So let's turn the speaker again. Thank you very much.